The car had pulled alongside of them. The man leaned out of the car.
"One Jap is one too many. I told them, 2 Japs today, maybe 10 Sunday. Don't come back."
He'd gone back to his poker games, and Tommy didn't go to town until they moved on to another farm. After several weeks, Tommy, short and squat and studious-looking, approached him in the showers.
"There's an excellent church in this town," he said. "A true Christian church, where they are glad to have us. Why don't you come with me this Sunday?"
"Shove it,"
he had said, and immediately wished he hadn't when he saw the hurt look in Tommy's eyes.
"Just this once, please,"
he pleaded, taking a step forward.
"I'm quite sorry about the other time. I'd like to make it up to you for having given you such a poor start."
In the end, he had agreed, and it seemed that Tommy was right. It was a small church, but filled to capacity and, after the service, the congregation had displayed their friendliness to the extent of keeping them standing outside for an hour, asking questions and conversing endlessly, as though they were old friends. By the third Sunday, they were having dinner with Mr. Roberts, who had 6 children, but still insisted on their coming. Ichiro was delighted, and Tommy was beaming. It was the 6th or 7th Sunday, he couldn't remember exactly. But with the heat and the crowded benches, he started to squirm out of his jacket, twisting as he did so, and he saw the white-haired Negro standing in the back. He wondered then why the usher hadn't gotten out one of the folding chairs, which were often used when bench space ran out. He was comforted when, a few minutes later, he heard chairs being rattled in the back. He took another look after the minister had finished his sermon, and the Negro was still standing. The chairs had been for the Kennedys, who had arrived late, and they were sitting only a few feet away from the Negro. There was no whispering, no craning as there had been in the other church. Yet, everyone seemed to know of the colored man's presence. The service continued. The minister stood silent and motionless on the stage. The congregation remained seated, instead of disintegrating impatiently as usual, into a dozen separate chattering groups. Very distinctly, through the hollowness of the small church, echoed the slow, lonely footsteps of the intruder across the back, down the stairs, and out into the hot sun. As suddenly, the people came to life like actors on a screen, who had momentarily been rendered inanimate by some mechanical failure of the projector. He had gone straight back to the bunkhouse by himself. He was mad, and it hadn't helped any when he couldn't get into the poker game right away. It was almost an hour before someone dropped out and, when they quit late that night, he had dropped his earnings plus a week and a half's wages still to be earned. A few days later, Tommy, reluctant to lose one who had appeared such a promising recruit, tried to justify the incident.
"The ways of the Lord are often mysterious," he had said. "There are some things which we cannot hope to understand. You will feel better by next Sunday."
"Save the holy crap for yourself," he had replied. "Seems to me like you goddamn good Christians have the supply spread out pretty thin right now."
And then Tommy had revealed himself for the poor, frightened, mistreated Japanese that he was.
"Holy cow!"
he had exclaimed in a frantic cry.
"They like us. They treat us fine. We're in no position to stick out our necks when we've got enough troubles of our own."
"Good deal. You hang on to it, will you? Son of a bitch like you needs a good thing like that."
When he left him to join the others, whom Freddy was entertaining with his inexhaustible stock of filthy jokes, he thought he heard a whimper. "That happened before I had to make the choice," he thought. That was when we were in the relocation camp, out in the god-awful desert, and it seemed like living to be able to be free of the camp for brief periods, working for peanuts on a sugar beet farm. That was all before I made a mess of everything by saying no, and I see now that my miserable little life is still only a part of the miserable big world.
It's the same world. The same big, shiny apple with streaks of rotten brown in it. Not rotten in the center where it counts, but rotten in spots underneath the skin. And a good sharp knife can still do a lot of good. I have been guilty of a serious error. I have paid for my crime as prescribed by law. I have been forgiven, and it is only right for me to feel this way, or else I would not be riding unnoticed and unmolested on a bus along a street in Seattle on a gloomy, rain-soaked day. Through the front of the bus, he saw the clock tower of the depot. He could have ridden a couple of stops further, but he rose and pulled the cord. He stepped out into the rain, turning the short collar of the raincoat snugly up around his neck. Here was the bus station, the same stretch of concrete walk on which he had stood with his suitcase that morning he had first come back to Seattle and home, and yes, friends too. He was young still, but a little wiser. Perhaps he was a bit more settled in heart and mind. And the rain, it was appropriate. "After the rain, the sunshine," he murmured. It wouldn't be quite as easy as all that. It could rain forever for all he knew. Still, there had been a lot of goodness that he had not expected. There was room for all kinds of people. Possibly, even for one like him. I've got to keep thinking that. I will keep thinking that. It's only a thread. But how much it seems in a life where there might have been nothing. He walked up to the depot and turned up Jackson Street and, while he waited for the light to change, the cluster of people at the bus stop hardly gave him a glance. 11. He lay on the bed, listening to the occasional night noises, which drifted through the walls of the old frame building, which was both business and home. There was, now and then, the gentle whir of rubber tires speeding over concrete, the foggy blast of a semi's air horn far off in the distance, the muffled rumble and jar of trains being switched not too far away. It was a time of quiet, but for Ichiro, the uneasiness prevailed. The telephone rang out in the store. He listened to its ringing. Once, twice, three times. Ah, he got it.
"Ichiro."
"Yes?"
"It's for you. The telephone."
Throwing his legs over the side, he fumbled his feet into shoes.
"Ichiro,"
called the father, with a bit more insistence. "Yes, yes, I'm coming." Trailing laces which clicked along the floor, he hurried out. Behind the counter, the old man was holding the receiver out to him. "Who is it?"
"I do not know. Somebody who wishes to speak with you," said the father, with a shrug.
"Hello?" he said into the phone.
"Ichi?"
It was Freddy.
"Yes. This is Freddy."
He sounded like a little kid. "Hello, Freddy."
"Hi. Let's do something."
"What?"
"What you mean, what?" "Something. I got the car. You doing anything?"
"Taking it easy."
"What the hell? You gotta get out and do something. I'll pick you up, huh?"
"Well,
I'll tell you what. I'm getting me a shine and maybe fixed up. You remember where that place, what used to be a cigar store, is? On Jackson, up from where the movie was. You know, that place where all the guys used to buy the dirty comics."
"Yes, I remember."
"Great. It's a shine parlor now. I'll see you there in 15-20 minutes. Check?"
"Well, I..."
"God damn it. You gotta get out and live, I told you. If you ain't shown when I get there, I'm coming to your place."
"Okay, okay," he said, with more irritation than willingness.
"Great. 15-20 minutes, like I said."
He put the phone down and reached for a package of cigarettes. The old man was thumbing through a catalog of store equipment with a satisfied look on his face.
Who was it?
He inquired, without looking up. Freddy.
Akimoto-san's boy.
Wants me to go out with him.
Yeah, that is fine. You go and have a good time.
He punched open the register and handed his son a couple of bills.
Christ, Pa, he blurted out. I can't keep taking money from you.
Pretty soon you get a job,
his father said softly.
It will take time, I know. It is all right. I want you to have the money. I want you to have a good time.
I don't know. I'm not a kid anymore.
Take, he urged. It will make me happy. Mama gone. Taro someplace else. Only you and me now. We will find a way.
His face puffed up as if he were going to cry. Okay, Pa. If that's how you want it. He slipped the money into his shirt pocket.
Yeah,
said the father, as he walked to the front and locked the door and began to turn off the lights.
I'm going to fix up a little bit. Buy a few things for the store. You can go to school and help me sometime, maybe. That would be good.
Sure. He sensed that his father was, perhaps, beginning to feel a bit lonesome. In the semi-darkness, he appeared very much like a frightened, lonely man, and not at all the free and expansive soul he had seemed so short a time before.
Sure.
If a job doesn't turn up, I might go to school and help you out here, Pa.
That would be nice, Ichiro. Mama would like that.
Great, he said curtly, and was immediately sorry. She's gone now, he thought. I don't have to fight her or hate her anymore. It will take Pa a little while to get used to being without her. I can give you a hand around here until something comes up, or I decide to go back to school, he said soothingly. The old man nodded agreeably as he walked to the kitchen with the catalog. Freddy was up on the chair, getting his shoes shined by a white-haired, scrawny Negro, who whipped the polish rag expertly over the now gleaming shoes.
Itchy boy, shouted Freddy. Pull up a chair.
Ichiro climbed up next to his friend, surveying the dingy narrowness of the place, which was garishly dominated by a multicolored giant jukebox standing in the back.
How about it, rabbit?
The Negro looked up without breaking the whipping rhythm of the rag and, in marked contrast to the celerity of his arms, uttered lazily,
Not tonight, boy. Tomorrow, maybe. All my gals are booked, I tell you. What the hell? My buddy here's been stirring for 2 goddamn years, and he can't wait till tomorrow. Yeah?
He craned his neck to appraise Ichiro. Then he looked at Freddy.
Same deal? Yeah, yeah. Same as me. Good boy. If they had come for me, I would have told them where to shove their stinking uniform, too.
He finished off the shoes with several long, slow swipes.
Shine?
He asked Ichiro.
No thanks.
Rabbit ran the rag lightly over Ichiro's shoes and straightened up. Freddy hopped down and put a hand on Rabbit's shoulder.
Come on, Rabbit. Fix us up. Sorry. It's like I told you. I want to help, but that's how it is. Shit, said Freddy, stepping back angrily. Always telling me you can get a guy anything he wants. Big talk, that's what.
Rabbit smiled calmly.
I got you that nice Elgin real cheap. So what do you want me to do? Go to bed with it? You're small enough, all right. All right. All right, wise guy. I got your number now. Ain't nothing but a bag of wind. Come on, Itchy. Let's blow.
Quickly, Rabbit stuck out his hand.
Two bits for the shine, mister.
Freddy dug up a quarter and slapped it into the outstretched palm.
How's about a nice radio cheap?
Said Rabbit. Without bothering to answer, Freddy stalked out with Ichiro close behind. They walked down the block to the car and got in. Lighting cigarettes, they sat and smoked in silence.
Well, that screws that, finally said Freddy.
What's that?
That damn rabbit. Always talking big. Anytime you want a gal, he's always saying to me, Rabbit's the boy to see. The guy's full of crap. From here on in, this boy's shining his own goddamn shoes.
He rolled down the window and flipped the cigarette at a passing car.
How about some pool?
Well,
you shoot pool?
Yes, but...
But what? Do you or don't you?
Yes, I do.
Well?
Sure. Freddy got out of the car, and Itchy followed. They walked back up the block, past the shine parlor, and around the corner to a pool hall. There were three tables, all empty. Freddy said hi to the sleepy-looking Japanese man behind the cigar counter.
Hello, young boy,
said the man in unschooled English.
Take table way in back, and don't make trouble.
He was a heavy man of around 50, with rumpled slacks and shirt.
Like hell I will. We're using the good table.
He went to the first table and, slipping the rack over the neatly set up balls, proceeded to jiggle them back into position. The man, his face hardening perceptibly, grabbed Freddy's arm and pulled him firmly away from the table.
I say back table. I see you play before. That one good enough for you. If you no like, get out.
Freddy glared back at the man, his hand reaching out to curl menacingly over the cue ball. Ichiro moved quickly between them. Come on, it isn't worth blowing your stack about. He jostled him lightly. I thought you were going to show me a good time.
Aw, friggin' Jap. Always out to give me a bad time.
He threw the rack on the table and said flippantly,
Okay, let's have a ball.
Still glaring at the man, he sauntered toward the last table. The man restrained Ichiro momentarily with a tug on his sleeve.
That one, he no good. I know. Always trouble.
Sure, sure, said Ichiro. He'll be all right. Shaking his head, the man went back to his stool behind the counter. Freddy was pulling cues off the wall rack, holding them up against his eye for alignment, brandishing them like swords for weight, and testing them for balance on a finger.
Hell, give me a broomstick,
he said exasperatedly. He tried a few more, and finally selected one.
Foot for break, itchy boy.
He tossed a coin high into the air.
Heads,
said Ichiro, his back toward his companion as he examined the cues against the wall. Freddy snatched the falling coin and, without a glance, put it back in his pocket.
You lose. My break.
Cue ball in hand, he spent many deliberate moments spotting it for the initial shot. He settled on the location close to the bank of the table and crouched to make the break. Jiggling the cue, sighting, jiggling the stick some more, shifting his feet, moving his buttocks, he finally pulled back and plunged the stick forward. There was a faint click as the cue flailed up and away from the felt. The white ball, rolling askew, banked against the side and rolled easily into the neat pyramid, merely distorting it a bit.
Son of a bitchin' cue!
It all happened too quickly for Ichiro to intercede. The stick flashed up and down with a resounding whack against the table. A piece flew up and against the wall.
All right, boy. All right, boy. You asked for it.
The crimson-faced man was hurrying toward them.
Rotten Jap,
Freddy plucked the ball and threw it at the furious proprietor, who sought cover behind one of the tables. The ball crashed into a case of empty pop bottles.
Beat it!
They ran for the door, Freddy managing to toss a few more balls in the general direction of the enemy, and Ichiro running blindly, with only the desire to get away. There was no further pursuit, but they ran all the way to the car. Once again, they sat in silence, waiting until they regained their breath and then lighting cigarettes.
You're crazy, said Ichiro.
Ah, he won't do nothing.
He might.
Let him. Who gives a damn?
Freddy punched his butt against the dash, letting the burning crumbs fall to the floor of the car. This what you call living it up?
Better nothing. You got something better to do? Give.
I could be sleeping. Freddy chuckled, then stared blankly ahead. He looked much more haggard than he had in the apartment that day, which seemed such a long time ago. Ichiro felt deeply sorry for his friend who, in his hatred of the complex jungle of unreasoning that had twisted a life-giving yes into an empty no, blindly sought relief in total hateful rejection of self and family and society. And this sorrow, painfully and humanely felt, enlarged still more the understanding which he had begun to find through Ken and Mr. Carrick and Emmy and, yes, even his mother and father. He turned to Freddy, who stared ahead now with the face of a tired old man. Freddy? There was no response. He tried again, a little louder this time. Freddy?
Yeah, that's me.
We can go to my place.
What for?
Talk?
We're talking now.
Okay. What's bothering you? Freddy looked thoughtful, then defiant.
Nothing. How come you ask?
Seems to me like you're out to lick the system single-handed.
I ain't. But if I am, so what? I'm just living.
Take it easy, Freddy.
Aw, can it?
Anger pulled his face taut as he yelled at Ichiro.
I didn't ask you out to give me no lecture. I get my belly full at home. And that fat pig, soon as I line me up a real babe, she's done. I'm getting sick of her.
Ichiro wondered if he should try again to get Freddy to go home with him. He didn't enjoy being with him, but now that he was, he felt some reluctance about leaving him alone. There's beer and whiskey at my place, he said. Why don't we go?
Nuts. We're gonna do something.
What?
Who gives a damn? Anything.
Thoroughly disgusted, he replied evenly. Fine. Have a good time. He pushed open the door and started to get out.
Wait a minute, wait a minute!
Shouted Freddy.
We'll do something.
Ichiro sat down. All right. Name it.
Sure.
Freddy thought for a moment.
Let's go have a drink. Someplace nice, with people around, but not jumping. You know?
No, I don't.
You know, for Christ's sake. You know what I mean?
Yes, I know just the place, he replied, with heavy irony in tone and expression. The Club Oriental.
No, what the hell you...
He started. Then, brightening mischievously.
Why not?
Wait a minute, he objected hastily. You're not taking me seriously.
Free world, ain't it?
Sure, but...
Chicken?
No, no, but there's no sense in asking for trouble. Freddy was starting the car, his face aglow with devilish excitement.
Ain't nobody telling this boy to stay on his side of the fence. I got teeth and hair like anybody else.
I thought they were laying for you,
So what? I ain't scared no more. You and me, we can take 'em.
Oh, no. I got more brains than you think.
Ichiro heard his voice rising with a mounting anger.
What in the hell is the matter with you? We've got troubles now. What good is it going to do to look for more? You're in real bad shape if you think.
Freddy raised his hand defensively.
Whoa, whoa.
He smiled impishly.
A drink. That's all we want. A nice, quiet drink. We're going there and have a peaceful drink, maybe two. No trouble. No fights. Anybody says anything, I'm heading for the door, okay?
If you really mean it, sure.
Okay, that's how it's gonna be. First sign of trouble, we blow. Check?
Fine.
Double check.
He shoved the lever into low gear and, with tires screeching, abusively whipped the car away from the curb and up the street. Wanting to protest, wanting to get away from Freddy and his madness, Ichiro sat silently, trying to resign himself to the situation. Freddy was much too erratic to be trusted. Still, there was a hint of logic in his stubborn defiance. It was a free world, but they would have to make peace with their own little world before they could enjoy the freedom of the larger one. Maybe Freddy is on the right track, he told himself. But he found no comfort in his thoughts. Freddy drove up the hill, past the dingy stores, the decrepit hotels, the gambling joints, looking for an opening big enough for the car, and not finding one. He cursed a steady stream of violent oaths all the way around the block. Finally, he turned into the alley, drove up to the door of the club, and parked under a sign reading, "Absolutely no parking."
"You're asking for a ticket," warned Ichiro.
"So what? Ain't my jalopy."
He got out and waited for Ichiro.
"We aren't being very sensible. I'd rather not, you know."
"Can it? We're here, ain't we? Nothing's gonna happen."
"I have your word?"
Freddy yelled.
"I give you my word, didn't I? You want I should cross my heart on a stack of Bibles or something?"
He started toward the entrance without answering. Hitting the buzzer, they waited for the release to buzz back. Ichiro looked at Freddy, who for the first time appeared a bit apprehensive. It comforted him to know that he was on the defensive. Perhaps there wouldn't be any trouble. They both grabbed for the door as the buzzing started, and then they were inside. The place was dim, smoky, and crowded.
"I guess we picked a bad night,"
said Ichiro, hopefully. Freddy nodded silently. He looked all wound up, his face tense and watchful instead of arrogant.
"Shall we go?"
Freddy shook his head, not looking at his companion, but keeping his eyes roving vigilantly over the crowd.
"We're in,"
he said finally, pointing to the bar, where a couple was preparing to leave. They hurried to take over the stools, hemmed in, as it were, on both sides, and with his back to the people at the tables. Ichiro felt oddly secure. He lifted his glass and said, "Here's to Kenji."
"Who's he?"
"A friend who asked me to have a drink for him."
"Some guy in stir?"
"No, a friend."
"Okay, to your friend, wherever the son of a bitch may be."
"That wasn't necessary."
His voice was low and firm.
"Jesus," said Freddy, startled. "I didn't mean nothing. I'm drinking to him, ain't I? If the guy was a real son of a bitch, I wouldn't waste the price of a drink on him. If he's a friend of yours, he's okay with me, I'm telling you. To him, your friend."
He raised his glass. At that moment, it occurred to Ichiro that he and Ken had been talking in a very similar vein when they had sat at this very bar. It seemed appropriate. He smiled and raised his glass toward Freddy's. The glasses never met, for suddenly, Freddy's shoes banged against the bar as he shot straight back off the stool, Ichiro turned and felt sick at his stomach. Bull, grinning hideously, held Freddy helplessly by means of a beefy fist, which gripped the victim's coat collar, twisted tightly against his back. Freddy struggled.
Let go, you stupid bastard!
Make me, Jap boy!
Bull looked to the crowd for appreciation.
Let him go,
said Ichiro, a little nervously.
Make me,
said Bull, with the meanness in his dark face.
This little shit's been asking for it.
Cut it out, Bull,
said a voice out of the crowd. Jim Eng was pushing his way to the disturbance.
All right,
he kept repeating in an agitated squeak. Bull shoved Freddy around and pushed him toward the door. Someone grabbed at his arm, saying,
Leave him alone.
He shrugged off the hand angrily.
Anybody wants to butt in, I'll bust his balls for him.
The crowd opened up for Bull and Freddy. Ichiro, close behind, was momentarily restrained by a hand pulling at his sleeve. He turned, ready for the worst.
Stay out of it, fellow. It won't do much good.
The one who spoke was a pleasant-looking youth, with a black-gloved hand hanging with awkward stiffness at his side.
I haven't got much choice.
Let me buy you a drink. You're not the brawling kind.
The door slammed, and Freddy's loud protestations were cut off. Ichiro pushed his way out to the alley, where Bull was trying to propel his undersized opponent away from the illumination around the club's entrance. He ran up to the pair and took hold of Bull's arm.
Let him go, he pleaded. We won't come back.
I'm making damn sure of that. You goddamn Japs think you're pretty smart, huh? I wasn't fighting my friggin' war for shits like you.
Freddy, sensing his chance, drove an elbow sharply into his aggressor's stomach. Bull grunted, momentarily relaxing his grip, and Freddy wrenched himself free and sprawled forward. Ichiro, seeing Bull lunge to recapture his prey, threw his shoulder against the solid mass of flesh and muscle. They rolled down the alley, clawing at each other and straining muscles to seek a victory in the senseless struggle. When they stopped rolling, Ichiro managed to gain the top position. Straddling the infuriated Bull, he shoved his face against the hate-filled countenance of the one who chose to speak for those who had fought and died.
Please, he screamed. Please, don't fight.
And Bull cursed and strained and heaved with a strength which could not be restrained much longer. Driven by fear, urged by a need to fight this thing which no amount of fighting would ever destroy, Ichiro raised his fist and drove it down. He saw the eyes flinch, the head trying to avert the blow, and then the nauseating gush of blood from nose and mouth.
I'll kill you!
The words, spoken with icy fury, gurgled out through a mouthful of bloody sputum. And Ichiro looked into the angry eyes and saw that to quit now would mean to submit to that unrelenting fury. He raised his fist again, sick with what he was having to do. Before he could strike, however, he felt himself being pulled off.
That's enough, said someone.
Break it up,
said another. Bull was up on one elbow, his hate-filled eyes intent upon Ichiro.
Okay,
he grunted, a hint of a smile showing cruelly through the streaks of blood.
Bull, no more,
a voice said authoritatively.
Yeah? Who says?
He wiped a sleeve across his mouth and started to push himself off the ground, his eyes never for a moment wavering from Ichiro's. Ichiro watched, not wanting to fight, and making no effort to run from the hands which held him only loosely. There was a sudden clatter of footsteps, and he saw Bull, not quite in a sitting position, raise both arms defensively as he fell backward. In that instant, Freddy plunged his heel into the stomach of the fallen opponent. Bull gasped with pain, swore mightily, and seemed almost to throw himself upright. Startled by the speedy recovery, Freddy stood stock still for a moment. Not until Bull had taken steps toward him did he make a frantic dash for the car. Bull, clutching at his midsection with one arm, managed half a dozen steps before stumbling to his knees. He cursed continually, the hateful sounds painfully strained. Again, he rose to his feet and progressed erratically toward the car, which Freddy was furiously trying to start. Just as it roared to life, Bull pulled open the door. He reached in and grabbed at Freddy, who squirmed away and countered by swinging a wrench, which caught Bull on the side of the head. The car jumped forward, throwing Bull roughly aside. The motor coughed. There was a hectic jiggling of the gas pedal, and the car screeched through the alley. A pedestrian, about to cross the alleyway, jumped out of the way with comic haste.
"Crazy damn fool," said a voice behind Ichiro.
Ichiro watched the car plunge out across the street. The next instant, there was a muffled thud. The car which Freddy drove seemed to jump straight into the air and hang suspended for a deathly clear second. Then it flipped over and slammed noisily against the wall of the building on the other side of the street. Not until then did he notice the smashed front end of another car jutting into view. Someone was running to the overturned car. There was an excited shout, and another, and soon, people were eagerly crowding toward the wreck from all directions. He stood there alone for a long while, feeling utterly exhausted, knowing somehow that Freddy would have to fight no longer. Over by the club's entrance, Bull was sitting with his back against the trash can. His head hung between his knees. He went up to him and said, "Bull,
get me a drink," he moaned, without stirring.
"Sure."
"Damn."
"What?"
"That son of a bitch. I hope it killed him."
The club door was open. Inside, the jukebox was playing for one couple at a table and a solitary figure at the bar who was too drunk to move. He went behind the bar and grabbed a bottle. A Japanese youth, probably about Taro's age, came running in. Flushed with excitement, he exclaimed to Ichiro,
"What a mess! Did you see? Poor guy must have been halfway out when the car smacked the building. Just about cut him in two. Ugh!"
He hastened into the phone booth. Ichiro took a drink out of the bottle and made his way back out to where Bull was sitting. "Here." Bull moaned, but made no move to accept the bottle. He took hold of his hair, pulled him straight, and shoved the bottle against the bloody mouth. Bull drank, coughed, and drank some more. Then, grabbing the bottle away from Ichiro, he let his head drop once more.
"They say he's dead," said Ichiro gently.
"So what?"
"Nothing. Just that. That. I'm sorry."
Bull swung his face upward, his eyes wide with horror, the mouth twisted with rage, yet trembling at the same time. The throaty roar was mixed with streaks of agonized screaming, verging on the hysterical.
"Yeah? Yeah? I ain't sorry one friggin' bit. That little bastard seen it coming a good long while. I ain't sorry, you hear? I ain't sorry. Damn right I ain't. I hope he goes to hell. I hope he..."
The words refused to come out any longer. Mouth agape, lips trembling, Bull managed only to move his jaws sporadically. Suddenly, he clamped them shut. His cheeks swelled to bursting, and the eyes, the frightened, lonely eyes, peered through a dull film of tears and begged for the solace that was not to be had. He screamed, and, with the brute strength that could only smash, hurled the whiskey bottle across the alley. Then he started to cry. Not like a man in grief or a soldier in pain, but like a baby, in loud, gasping, beseeching howls. A siren moaned, shrieked, then moaned to a stop with a screeching of brakes. A door slammed. Official voices yelled at the crowd. The murmur of the curious filtered through the alley. Ichiro put a hand on Bull's shoulder, sharing the empty sorrow in the hulking body, feeling the terrible loneliness of the distressed wails, and saying nothing. He gave the shoulder a tender squeeze, patted the head once tenderly, and began to walk slowly down the alley, away from the brightness of the club and the morbidity of the crowd. He wanted to think about Ken and Freddy and Mr. Carrick and the man who had bought the drinks for him and Emmy, about the Negro who stood up for Gary, and about Bull, who was an infant crying in the darkness. A glimmer of hope. Was that it? It was there someplace. He couldn't see it to put it into words, but the feeling was pretty strong. He walked along, thinking, searching, thinking and probing, and, in the darkness of the alley, of the community that was a tiny bit of America, he chased that faint and elusive insinuation of promise as it continued to take shape in mind and in heart. Afterward, in search of John Okada. I'm back in Seattle, and not what I was when I lived here. Seattle isn't the city it was when I lived here. The only yellow motion then was lanterns in Chinatown. The yellow mouth in town was Ruby Chow, blowing, blowing, sweet and sour hoochie coochie, and a vision of the continuity of Chinese culture in the Pacific Northwest that was pure Jack London science fiction. All bunk. And totally believed by gaga non-yellows who eat out Chinese to get away from real life. If they couldn't disappear into Shangri-La and passive immortality, they could put a fantasy in their stomach. Ruby Chow's was loud and fancy, with Chinamans out of movies and funny papers, as if the Chinese Americans were the most accomplished, the best, the pioneering of the yellows here. I lived and worked here writing, as if the greatest Asian-American writer who ever wrote had never lived here. John Okada was Japanese-American, Nisei, born and raised in Seattle. His first and last novel, Nono Boy, about a Japanese-American who served hard time for refusing to volunteer to be inducted into the Army in World War II, is set in Seattle. To Asian-Americans outside of Seattle, John Okada is the proof of our yellow soul. I never heard of John Okada the 4 years I lived here. Think of being born to a people who have no culture, no literature, no writing, no writers, except in some past across an ocean. In 200 years and all your generations of white people living and creating new American experience and know-how. Not one word, not one joke, not one book. What if there were no whites in American literary history? There is no Melville, no Mark Twain, no Kay Boyle, no Gertrude Stein, no Tom Robbins, not even a Rod McEwen. A white American writer would feel edgy if all the books ever written in America were by blacks, browns, reds, yellows, and all whites had ever published were cookbooks full of recipes for apple pie and fried chicken. That's what I grew up with. A literary tradition of cookbooks and autobiographies by the children of Christian converts and Pocahontas yellows, whites call progressive for marrying out white. I grew up told no one knew anything else about yellow writing because there was nothing else to know. In our 150 years, 9 Chinaman generations, 4 Japanese-American generations, 3 Filipino, 2 Korean. Not one of us had an urge to say, what's what and who's who about ourselves. In all that time, All we had to look to was some dumpy plastic lanterns swinging in Chinatown, like fat men strung up by a lynch mob to bloat. I'll tell you right now, I never won a fist fight in my life. I don't know kung fu or karate. I'm not a fast runner either. If I can't talk my way out of a fight, I've had it. I'm not known for being brave or especially savvy. I'm proof that the urge to self-expression is nothing special, and writing isn't an act of courage. It makes no sense to me to be thought of as the first yellow writer of anything, much less plays, in the history of my people. To believe that I was the first to write was to believe Asian Americans were less than gutless all their history here. I didn't want to be the first yellow to write. I didn't want to be the first yellow to write in Seattle. I didn't want to be a freak. And I didn't want the responsibility for being deep and true that comes with being the first of your people to do it with words. For me, the discovery of John's 1957 novel was like a white writer feeling gloomy and alone in a literary history, discovering Mark Twain. No-No Boy proved I wasn't the only yellow writer in yellow history. The book was so good, it freed me to be trivial. Back in 1957, John said things Asian Americans are afraid to think, much less say today. Things that every yellow feels. I've known all my life that I am not Chinese, and I am not white American. I was brought up to believe there was nothing else for me to be but a Chinese foreigner or a fake white American, as if there were nothing for whites to be other than British subjects or American colonists. Sometime 200 years ago, whites declared they were neither British subjects nor American colonists. They were Americans. Asian Americans have been wandering around the self-pity and pompous theories of the so-called Asian American identity crisis since a massive missionary effort to convert us to the notion that civilization is founded on religion, and the best religion is the one that worships one God. Christian missionaries controlled our population by denying us access to our women and allowing only Christian converts to marry. The 20s produced a generation of Asian Americans who didn't know who they were. We still don't. John Okada shows the identity crisis to be both totally real and absolutely fake, in a book that is still too strong for many yellows to read. Ichiro comes back to Seattle from prison, to a home full of loonies. His brother despises him for refusing to serve in the war and joins the army to make up for Ichiro's disgrace. Ichiro's father is a slobbering lush, terrorized by his wife, who believes Japan has won the war, and the papers are holding back the bad news from the whites. She looks to Ichiro as an ally and accomplice to her madness and says, "Think more deeply, and your doubts will disappear. You are my son." And triggers a spinning, running internal monologue that is one of the most powerfully moving passages in Asian American writing. "No," he said to himself, as he watched her part the curtains and start into the store. "There was a time when I was your son. There was a time that I no longer remember when you used to smile a mother's smile and tell me stories about gallant and fierce warriors who protected their lords with blades of shining steel, and about the old woman who found a peach in the stream and took it home, and when her husband split it in half, a husky little boy tumbled out to fill their hearts with boundless joy. I was that lad in the peach, and you were the old woman. And we were Japanese, with Japanese feelings and Japanese pride and Japanese thoughts, because it was all right then to be Japanese and feel and think all the things that Japanese do, even if we lived in America. Then there came a time when I was only half Japanese, because one is not born in America and raised in America and taught in America, and one does not speak and swear and drink and smoke and play and fight and see and hear in America, among Americans, in American streets and houses, without becoming American and loving it. But I did not love enough, for you were still half my mother, and I was thereby still half Japanese, And when the war came and they told me to fight for America, I was not strong enough to fight you. And I was not strong enough to fight the bitterness, which made the half me, which was you, bigger than the half of me, which was America. And really, the whole of me that I could not see or feel. Now that I know the truth when it is late, and the half of me which was you is no longer there, I am only half of me, and the half that remains is American by law, because the government was wise and strong enough to know why it was that I could not fight for America, and did not strip me of my birthright. But it is not enough to be only half an American, and know that it is an empty half. I am not your son, and I am not Japanese, and I am not American. John Okada was not Nono Boy. He served in World War II, hanging out of an airplane over Japanese-held islands, asking their occupants in their own language to give up. When I came to Seattle to look for John Okada, I learned he was dead. I got the impression his family was ashamed of the book. They thought of me as a yellow activist, a troublemaker, for even bringing the book back to their minds. They had put him in his old uniform, buried him in Seattle, and forgotten the book. John's widow, Dorothy, stayed away from the funeral and won't come back to Seattle. John died in February 1971 of a heart attack. He was 47. I missed meeting John by a few months. If only I'd read his book sooner, I might have gotten together with Lawson Inada, the Sansei poet, and gone driving down to L.A. looking for John sooner. As it was, his family in Seattle said they'd talk to us only if John's widow would talk to us. I broke out the old suit I'd worn at my high school graduation, and Lawson and I drove to L.A. "I wish you had come visiting when John was alive," Dorothy said. "He would have liked to meet you." In the 15 years since Charles Tuttle of Tokyo had published the novel, not one yellow had come up to John to say, "Hey, John, I read your book, and I think it's pretty nice." We asked her about John's second novel. Charles Tuttle had sent me a copy of a letter John had written him saying, "I am now at work on a second novel, which will have for its protagonist an immigrant Issei rather than a Nisei. When completed, I hope that it will to some degree faithfully describe the experiences of the immigrant Japanese in the United States. This is a story which has never been told in fiction, and only in fiction can the hopes and fears and joys and sorrows of people be adequately recorded. I feel an urgency to write of the Japanese in the United States, for the Issei are rapidly vanishing, and I should regret if their chapter in American history should die with them." John wrote that in 1956. Dorothy said he'd almost finished a first draft before he died. Then she told us something that turned our blood to puke in our veins. After John died, she offered all of John's manuscripts, notes, and correspondence to the Japanese American Research Project at UCLA. John Okada was then, and still is, the only known Japanese American novelist. His Nono Boy, the only Japanese American novel, he belongs to Japanese American history and American literature. But the Japanese American Research Project refused to so much as look at the Okada papers. These champions of Japanese American history encouraged Dorothy to destroy the papers. Lawson and I looked around her little apartment for signs of John. "I had to move," Dorothy said. "I could not afford to keep the house and put the children through college. I didn't know what to do with John's things. Nobody had any use for them. Nobody wanted them. I burned them." "Everything?" I asked. "Everything," she said. And I wanted to kick her ass around the block. I wanted to burn UCLA down. Instead, we stayed up late, talking about her life, talking about her marriage to John, keeping her up, and asking every now and then about a letter, a story, a scrap of paper. But the answer was always the same. Burned. Back in Seattle again, the family agrees to see us. The brothers don't look like the heavies of the piece. They're proud of the book, talk freely and feed us sushi, Freddy, John's father, is 84 and is lying down in the next room. Old age sickness, he says, when I step in to shake hands and say hello. A little stroke a while ago, he says. Out his window, Robert and Roy point toward Pioneer Square. John was born in the old Merchants Hotel, upstairs, they say. They point down toward the International District, to a bit of gray between the top of Puget Sound Hotel and the top of another brick building. That was the old Yakima Hotel. Our father owned that. And they point out the other hotels in sight that Freddie owned. They talk about growing up in the Merchants Hotel and spill bits of John Okada that could mean anything to Sumida the scholar, Inada the Sansei poet, and me, the only Chinese-American in the room. John was born in a hotel room with the help of a Japanese midwife in September of 1923. He went to Bailey Gatzert Elementary and Broadway High. He might have collected stamps. Roy says John had always wanted to write something about the Issei, the first generation. They didn't know if John had actually started writing that book. I tell them what Dorothy told me. He wrote it, he died, it's gone, burned. No one looks at anybody else. Steve Sumida looks out the window to the King Street Station clock tower. I look over the empty chair between Roy and Robert to a picture on the wall, a family portrait. After a while, I ask about the family and learn the Okadas are remarkably artistic. Roy, the oldest son, is a graphic designer. John was a writer. Frank, a younger brother, is a well-known painter. We are finally talking about the book again. The clock tower, the Wonder Bread factory, all the landmarks are in the book, Robert says. Yeah, Roy says. We all laugh. We've all been to Seattle. We've all read the book. John's brothers and Frank Ishida, John's old fishing partner, Doris Mitchell, John's boss at the Seattle Public Library all remember John's brains, his brilliance, his bright shining eyes, Doris Mitchell says. She's retired, neat, powdered, and carries a white handkerchief tucked under the cuff of her left sleeve. She lives in one of those awful places where old people make friends out of other old people come to die here under discreet and watchful eyes. The place is air-conditioned, piped and wired like a hospital. It's burglar-proof. The front door seems off a bank vault. Lawson, Inada, and me stepped in to talk with her about John, like other people talk stick-em-up for money. She had the complexion of cabbage. She had all the facts of John's education, residences, and employment memorized. She recited John's resume so affectionately I couldn't watch her. So reverently, I was afraid to touch her when I thought she was crying. Of all the people we'd talked to about John, only Doris Mitchell effortlessly, deeply, unabashedly, tried to bring him back to life right before our eyes. Dorothy was surviving John when we met her. The brothers felt close to John, but didn't know that much about his business. Doris chanted the facts and figures, the dates and places of John Okada from the letters and cards he'd sent her, first week after week, then month after month, then once every 6 months, then Christmas cards once a year, and an occasional letter. In an act of librarian's passion, she cataloged the facts of the man from about who knows what. Neither me nor Lawson asked to read John's letters to her. Not that we have dirty minds, or afraid of finding out something we don't want to know, or a code of the West about respecting privacy. We thought of asking. We just never asked. We were no longer visitors come to interview someone who had a line on the John Okada who wrote Nono Boy. We were participants in an old white woman's seance. There's old mellowed emotion cooking in her voice that makes the facts sound deep with John's presence. But without her voice, they're just facts. He went to Bailey Gatzert Elementary, Broadway High, Minidoka, Scottsbluff Junior College with Frank Ishida, volunteered for military service with Ishida. Ishida went his way in the service, and John was discharged a sergeant in 1946. He graduated from the University of Washington, heavy into English lit and, in John's words, narrative and dramatic writing, history, sociology. M.A. Columbia U. 1949. He met Dorothy there, brought her back to Seattle, got a B.A. in librarianship at the University of Washington, then married her, or vice versa. John Okada worked as Doris Mitchell's assistant in the business reference department of the Seattle Public Library, moved to Detroit to take a job for more money, and hopefully more time to write at the Detroit Public Library. The work was long hours, no growth, and unrewarding. The neighborhood Christian church didn't want Japanese Americans in their congregation. John became a technical writer for Chrysler Missile Operations of Sterling Township, Michigan. He wrote Doris Mitchell he had no time to write his new book, and he felt Dorothy and the children were unhappy. As part of his plot to leave Detroit, he prepared a resume and autobiographical essay. Dorothy hadn't destroyed everything after all. The bits of John folded and tucked away in her books, left in pockets, in the bottoms of drawers, began to find their way back into Dorothy's hands. The resume and profile he wrote to get him and his family out of Detroit in 1956 is the only writing by John Okada on John Okada we've seen. At age 33, I am a married man who feels that he is uncommonly devoted to his wife and unusually fortunate in having two wonderful children, a son approaching five and a daughter who recently touched six. Normal feelings for a normal husband and father, one might say. But I choose to think that my family is quite special. Perhaps I have been endowed with a larger capacity for normalcy than most people. Next to my family, and of somewhat lesser importance, is my personal writing. Reduced to an avocation, though a disciplined one, my writing finally seems to be making headway. A novel completed a year ago is scheduled for distribution this coming June or July. A second is in the works and progressing sporadically. My health is good, 2 days lost because of illness in the past 5 years. I make an effort to be consistently punctual. Both a 4 and 9 inch snowfall combined with a 16-mile drive proved somewhat time-consuming this past winter, however. And I do not mind working under pressure or digging my way out from under a mountain of material. No objections to overtime, homework, or disrupted vacation plans. The facts of his life, school, college, camp, service, more college, marriage, kids, movement across the country following jobs. Nothing extraordinary. Nothing revealing about Okada, the man or the writer. Maybe his feeling, endowed with a larger capacity for normalcy than most people, is a clue. I wonder about the writer who can resist mentioning the title of his novel on the eve of its release. If he needs time to write, I wonder about his begging for overtime, homework, and disrupted vacation plans. This is all that's left of John Okada. His one novel, Nono Boy, Seattle, the few memories of him a few Seattleites still keep. His family, a few friends, and his grave. This month, Asian American writers and word punks like me from all over the country are coming to Seattle to meet each other here because Seattle's special. A lot of our history's here. Several pioneer Asian American journalists and writers come from here. James Sakamoto, Monica Soné, Bill Hosokawa, Jim Yoshida. But John Okada is the only great one. I'm back in Seattle to say, John, I read your book. I like it a lot. Frank Chin, Seattle, June 1976. This concludes Nono Boy by John Okada. Narrated by David Shee. Copyright 1976 by Dorothy Okada. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with University of Washington Press and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright there too. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.